Welcome to today's Main Ingredient, a program designed to help you bring local farm fresh food to your table. I'm your host, Mickey Useups. My guest today is Roger Hill, the manager of O'Neill's Orchard in Pleasant Mount. Today's main ingredient is apples. Roger has spent the last decade transforming the orchard from a chemical-intensive operation into one that relies on organic principles. That's our topic for this week. Next week, we'll cover the unusual botany of this most common of fruits. That's when Chef Kate Worley of the Settlers Inn will chime in with some great recipes, and dietitian Carol Kinnear of Wayne Memorial Hospital will talk about their nutritional value. So let's get started on apples. Apples are something that seem very everyday, I think. Even the old phrase, an apple a day keeps the doctor away. That's how kind of ubiquitous they are in our culture. But the production of those apples is no simple affair. And joining us today to talk about that is Roger Hill. Roger manages a orchard in Pleasant Mount. And Roger, let's start off with what is actually involved in managing an orchard.
Well, let's see. I'll start somewhere. The idea that planting an orchard from the very beginning, selecting the varieties of trees that are appropriate and placing them in a way that makes the trees easier to take care of is one thing. But then the other thing is to inherit an orchard in a way like I did with O'Neill's that was set up under a plan or a style that was promoted by County Extension back in the early 80s. The way it was set up is the trees are like you would normally see in an orchard when you're passing down the road. They're relatively close together in nice straight rows. So managing this orchard, which was designed to have chemical inputs, doing it without chemicals has led to a kind of a strange hybrid of an orchard there that isn't designed for organic production. Neither the varieties in it are suited, not all of them, some of them are. And the site is too tightly packed, too close together for the trees to be able to dry off freely so that fungal diseases are less of a problem. Managing this orchard has to do more with just allowing the soil and everything to kind of recover from the chemistry that was used at one time. And being able to plug in certain inputs that are, you know, much less harmful to the guy on the tractor, especially, that's me. And just to follow along with the seasons and learn from it. It definitely was a big learning experience. It's one thing to read about things in the books and pruning books and stuff like that. But until you actually have, you know, a couple trees in the yard, then you kind of learn hands-on that it doesn't turn out exactly like the textbooks always say.
There's a lot to unpack in what you were talking about there. So as I understand it, you're operating this farm using organic principles in an orchard that was not designed to take advantage of the ways that the organic growing systems approach pest control, disease control, and things like that. Am I correct?
That's right.
So let's unpack some of that. One of the questions I want to establish from the beginning, you had said it was designed in the 80s. Is that when the orchard was planted?
Yes, there were three or four orchards in the county. There's a couple of them still operating that were planted about that time. Okay. One was closer to Hunsdale on 670 Bertram's Orchard. And then this one, there's still one up near Pleasant Mount, or farther up north from O'Neill's, that's still maintained in the style.
When did you start managing the orchard?
I think it was about 10 years ago.
You've had some time on that curve then, that learning curve.
Right. The transition period is always the hardest, whether you're gardening, farming on a larger scale with chemical inputs. But it's amazing how resilient nature is. So the orchard was not as productive. It was kind of going downhill. Usually those orchards are, you get 40 or 45 years out of them. Mm-hmm. Then that's basically what they had planned for. But the trees in this particular orchard are on a size controlling rootstock, which would be generally termed a semi-dwarf. It's an M27 rootstock, which is a tree that's about two-thirds the size of the trees that you would see in one of the older orchards on an old farm, you know, with the standard size trees. It's on this rootstock. And then the design was they would be pruned to about head height and then more in an umbrella shape, almost like the weeping cherry trees that you see, the ornamental ones like that. And then the limbs would be very close to the ground, so you wouldn't be able to mow underneath of them. So one of the components was a glyphosate herbicide underneath to keep that strip underneath of the trees open. it was productive for many years. They have logs, you know, that show, you know, good production, and then kind of started to go downhill. When I was there, we're definitely seeing damage from the herbicides in the bark on the tops of the trees, and a lot of sprouts shooting up from around the base of the tree from the rootstock. And that's a sign of stress. Once we cold turkey quit all the chemistry, it was pretty ugly for a few years there.
Can we pause for just a second? Because you did mention rootstock. We probably want to talk to people about rootstock. The whole botany of the apples is complex. It's going to be difficult to unpack. I don't want to jump around too much. Could you just briefly talk about rootstock?
Sure. The apple trees that you see in orchards are, let's say if you see an orchard with Cortland apples, basically those Cortland apples all derive from a single tree, and they're taken from cuttings and grafted onto a separate rootstock. And those rootstocks are selected for disease resistance and basically for size control.
So they're like the base. The rootstock is really kind of the fruit production system.
The thing we need to remember is the size controlling rootstocks are great because you can keep the tree to a height that you can reach without using big ladders and pole pickers and things like that. The trade-off is that they don't live as long and that the root system is weak. That's why they're smaller. So the smallest ones need to be staked during their whole life in order to keep them from falling over. Some of the names of some of them, the ones that we use up here, is Bud 9. Bud is just the name of the extension station. I believe it's a Russian agricultural extension station where these really winter hardy rootstocks were developed. That's about the smallest size tree you'll be able to grow. Depending on the variety, they'll get like 15 feet high or so. There's one row of trees in O'Neill's orchard, the Honeycrisp, that are on that Bud 9. And then the M27 would be something like the next step up from that. They'll get 20 feet high or so and about as wide. So the rootstock determines how far apart you can space the trees without them being too crowded. There's a couple intermediate steps up next that you can get a little bit larger and a little bit larger until you get to the standard size tree. The rootstock that I'm using is an Antonovka tree rootstock, which is a really hardy Russian tree that's really good for our area. It doesn't get as large as some of the standard rootstocks do. The thing about it is it's really well anchored. It can compete with grass. The other smaller rootstocks, especially like the Bud 9, you have to keep the area around the tree clear from grasses because it really can't compete very well, especially in the beginning. And they don't live very long. The rootstock on the trees that I get for all of my work are this Antonovka rootstock. And the trees will get 30 feet high, and I plant them about 35 feet apart, but they could easily live 150 years or 200 years. So the production over the life of the tree and for what I'm trying to accomplish, which is, you know, community orchards and having these trees available. The other trade-off between the size-controlling rootstocks and the standard is that it generally takes longer for a tree to fruit on the standard rootstock.
So you were talking about that transition period. It got pretty ugly at the orchard when you cut out the chemistry and you kind of let things naturally kind of progress back to a more natural state of growing. What are some of the key parts of managing the orchard during that period?
First of all, we did soil testing to see what the mineral balance was. Apple trees can get along in a lot of different types of soils. They're pretty adaptable that way, but they all benefit from proper amount of the basic nutrients and the key nutrients for apples, calcium, potassium. Some of the trace minerals are definitely important as far as fruiting goes. So we needed to pay special attention to those. And the ones that we couldn't address with putting like rock powders on the soil, we would use foliar sprays of like the trace minerals, especially can easily be absorbed through the tree leaves with these foliar fertilizers. One of the things that we noticed to begin with, of course, was where the herbicides were, the goldenrod and things like that started to grow back pretty quick. Within the second year, we started seeing more green lacewings, ladybugs, things like that around natural predators. There aren't very many insects in the area that we have to pay attention to, but there are a few. In the first few years, the fungal diseases, apple scab, and a lot of those insects kind of, you know, did cause problems. And then there, of course, the apples that were nice, there were some that are resistant to apple scab and some of those diseases like the northern spy, didn't have a really pretty cosmetic appearance because of the late season fungal things things that aren't damaging, but they're just cosmetic, like sooty blotch and fly speck, which create like a gray sort of tone that can be polished off. It's actually just in the wax of the fruit, or it can be eaten. There's no harm in it or anything like that, but it's just not the polished apples that they were used to seeing there at the orchard. So it took a few years to figure out, using organically certifiable methods, what helped, what didn't help, what worked. And basically what we were going for was to restore the mineral balance and to restore some of the biology in the soil and on the leaf surface and in the plant. So we were applying compost teas, different concentrates of not exactly compost down in the soil, but it would have the same organisms. We could spray those on the trees to just to try to inoculate the area because it had been effectively kind of sterilized.
Now, where are you at the point where things are working?
Yeah, we've had consistent crops now for about the past 4 years. This year was an off year just because of the strange wet weather. Our apple scab program didn't work very well. So the varieties that are susceptible to that, McIntosh, Cortland, Empire, those have either a lot of cosmetic damage or actually had a lot of drop, and we didn't get any McIntosh at all.
Roger is such a wealth of knowledge. He even solved a long-standing mystery for me when I asked which apple is his personal favorite.
My favorite right today is Northern Spy, because we were just out there picking them. It's a really old apple, and it's really has a good following here in the Northeast and in this area. It's a good long-keeping apple, doesn't take a whole lot of fancy refrigeration or anything like that. It has a really complex flavor. It's not just plain sweet. It has some acidity to it, and as it ripens, it's almost like a banana. That whole flavor profile changes until you finally get into some pineapple-y sort of flavors and citrus sort of flavors at different points. That's probably my favorite right now. The other cool thing about it is they can get grapefruit size. So you get these pretty big, impressive apples.
I have to say that growing up, our neighbor down the road, a dairy farmer, had an apple tree, a few of them, this one particular apple tree, and they called it a banana apple tree. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if it wasn't a Northern Spy, because I know they said it was an old tree.
There's actually a variety called Winter Banana.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I knew you'd know. That is so awesome. I have wondered for years. People told me I was crazy that I had an apple that tasted like a banana.
Yep.
Now I know I was not crazy at all.
Yeah, I had one of those back in Ohio. They're such a good pollinator. They're used as pollinators in orchards. So just put a few in. An interesting story about the apple a day thing. You know where that came from?
No.
The Temperance League, because the only thing basically people were growing apples for was hard cider. So they were trying to get people to eat them.
They weren't very tasty though back then, I understand.
There's plenty of good tasting apples, but the main emphasis was on hard cider.
I'm one of those people who always wonders where those old adages come from.
Yeah,
so you just scratched two of my itches. That's all the time we have this week with Roger Hill, manager of O'Neill's Orchard in Pleasant Mount. Be sure to tune in next week for part two of Apples on Today's Main Ingredient. Here's a little sneak peek.
Pollination is really important, of course. A lot of people think that honeybees are the best way to go that way, but actually honeybees are not very attracted to apple blossoms. There's not much nectar and not really a lot of pollen. We do have a honeybee hive in the orchard, a couple boxes, and they do work on the trees in the spring, but they'd rather get the dandelions that are blooming at the same time in the orchard. And when I look at the trees, I see hundreds and hundreds of these little blue mason bees, little what you might call sweat bees, the seraphid flies, and bumblebees. And those are the guys that are really doing our apple tree pollinating for us.
And that makes that not using the pesticides that much more important, because those pollinators can be very easily affected by that. And without them, no apples.
Yeah, it does take insect pollination for apple trees.
Yeah, a windy day is not going to cut it for apples. You can learn more about today's main ingredient and our guests, as well as find some delicious recipes on the web at seedsgroup.net and look for the Today's Main Ingredient page or visit todaysmainingredient.org. This program is produced by Seeds of Northeastern Pennsylvania to promote renewable energy, sustainable agriculture, and sustainable living in today's world. Today's Main Ingredient is made possible in part by grants from the Greater Pike Community Foundation, the Wayne Pike Farm Bureau, Overlook Estate Foundation, and is sponsored by Fertile Valley Farms and Wolf Spring Farms. Two local farms working together. Call 410-961-0413.